Welcome to the Business Bookshelf podcast, where I interview business authors and talk about their newly released books. Today, I interview Dr. Nerit Weissblatt. Nerit is a former research fellow at the University of Southern California, Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. Her specialty is in the tech news field. Nerit is the author of the book, The Tech Clash and Tech Crisis Communication. This book provides an in-depth analysis of the evolution of tech journalism. The Emerging Tech Backlash is a story of pendulum swings. We are currently in tech dystopianism after a long period spent in tech utopianism. Tech companies were used to cheerleading coverage of product launches. This long tech press honeymoon ended and was replaced by a new era of mounting criticism focused on tech's negative impact on society. When and why did tech coverage shift? How did and how do tech companies respond to the rise of tech criticism? So sit back, or as I always say, if you're running, or if you're driving, or on the train, commuting, whatever you're doing, just sit back, or not sit back, but just enjoy the interview. So on with it. Thank you.
Glad to be here, Lance. Thank you for having me.
It's fantastic having you. So Nerit, where am I speaking to you from today?
I'm in Cupertino, California, also known as Applestown. It's giant spaceship is actually in my view.
Oh, wow. And so what do you think of that spaceship?
Beautiful.
Beautiful. Because I wonder if it's being like, I wonder if people are going to work there. Are people populating the spaceship these days, or is it just an empty building?
It's not empty. I see cars over there. So the lab people are in there, definitely.
No, that's fantastic. So my normal question to authors, just to get to know you a bit more, is what do you enjoy doing in Cupertino, California?
Well, being in the Bay Area is very different from where I used to live. So I'm originally from Israel. And in the past 4 years, I lived in Los Angeles, like mid-city LA. And a few months ago, I moved here. Get this story right. So I remember after my first night here, the building manager was very apologetic. And he told me, oh, you're in the apartment that faces the road. I'm so sorry for the noise. And I was like, what noise? There were no sirens from police cars, no helicopters above my head. That was a really good night. So to put things in perspective, I guess the major thing I'm enjoying here is the quietness.
And whereabouts from Israel did you come? From Tel Aviv or Jerusalem?
Near Tel Aviv.
Near Tel Aviv. And have you got family there still?
All my family and friends are there.
And how are they doing right now?
Better,
corona, because it's been...
They passed the corona before everybody else.
They did, but they're in a war zone almost at the moment.
They were. My family were actually in bombshells for 2 weeks. And I was worried sick about them, but now we are in a ceasefire, so...
Okay.
Hopefully, yeah.
Well, hopefully that stays like that for sure. And so on to pleasant things, more pleasanter things, there it. Could you give us an overview of your career, if you can?
Sure. So prior to my academic journey, I worked in the tech industry. So it's both tech journalism and tech PR. The way it worked, at first, I represented tech companies, pitched the media. And then I switched sides to be a tech reporter and deputy editor, now being on the receiving end of the PR emails. That was interesting. And I covered the tech ecosystem. Israel is the startup nation. So mainly startups and entrepreneurs. And around that time, I finished my master's degree in communication and political science. And when I looked for academic studies about my occupation, my passion, tech journalism, I found a depressing void. Most of, studies are about the political field.
Yeah.
And I was like, why does nobody studying this type of coverage? For me, it was the most interesting thing in the world, right? And I looked for examinations of the tech media agenda, and I found none. So I decided to do it myself. And now for more than a decade, I'm researching the interplay between the tech media and tech PR. So first, it was a PhD in communication, documenting the glorious days of innovation journalism and product journalism. And in the past 4 years, I'm researching the emerging techlash.
And I really, really enjoyed the book. So your book is called The Techlash and the Tech Crisis Tech Crisis Communication. And you say you wrote, did you write it as part of your PhD and then carried on writing it after that? Can you tell us how it was birthed and the purpose of writing it?
Sure. My initial research fellowship that I thought will end with a few articles in, you know, academic journal, was based on the criticism that the tech media is not tough enough. So my initial research was to examine the non-investigative nature of the tech coverage and the influence of corporate PR. But that was relevant to what I call the pre-techlash era. You know, the coverage that focused on product launch and, you know, mainly positive. But then the coverage shifted when I started the research to mounting criticism of big tech. So like any good startup, I needed to pivot. Like the research data like forced me to. And by research data, I mean the I used an AI media monitoring tool by MIT and Harvard and done content analysis. And the picture that I got was so different that it shifted my analysis to tech scandals and crisis communication. So not just like the roots of the change that I documented, but also the tech companies' PR efforts, how they defend themselves. And on top of that, I added in-depth interviews with leading tech journalists and PR professionals to get like the broader meaning of what I'm documenting, the techlash. And I had, I think, amazing access. You read it. So they were very open and honest that I think it really provided the inside story of this dramatic shift in coverage. And since I had so much information about this, you know, evolving battle between tech journalism and tech PR, I pitched it to an academic publisher, hoping that it would result in a book, and I got the contract.
Yeah. And it... And it's a really in-depth review. So a fascinating, fascinating read for sure. Nerit, can we start with the basics? Because you use two terms and I have mentioned them in the introduction. But could you explain the two different terms, tech utopianism and tech dystopia? What does it mean to live in tech dystopianism? Or maybe the two terms and what it means to live in tech dystopianism.
Sure, I think it's key. Thank you. I think the historical background is crucial here. So for decades, Silicon Valley's key players had this blind faith, okay, in the inherent good of computers and technology. Yeah. And tech journalists like helped romanticize the early internet. The digital revolution would bring an era of prosperity. And when your mindset is this tech optimism, actually, you believe that technology exists to make things better. It's a means to an end with a goal of improving. So in criticizing technology, criticism seems to be against innovation, against progress. So how dare you?
Yeah.
And when your mindset is tech pessimism, you believe the tech companies are a villain, you know, harm society, and like the criticism is legit and long overdue. So looking at the tech media coverage, journalists said the optimistic things out loud and, you know, whispered the dystopian remarks, but the techlash reversed this formula. So now we experience this huge shift in culture. And I think it happened in part due to the failure to live up to some of those, you know, more grandiose predictions we had about tech's impact. So I think it's the sense of disappointment of, you know, tech innovations not fulfilling all of their, you know, huge promises. And when you have, you know, you have inflated expectations, and then they, you know, crash down. And as you said, Lance, we are now living in this phase now.
I just looked at the definition of dystopia. So an imagined state or society in which there is great suffering or injustice, typically one that is totalitarianism or post-apocalyptic. And so is that what you're seeing from a lot of tech companies? Are there, is the fear, and I think that was during the Trump presidency, that the fear that there's going to be, you know, that they're going to dominate and there's going to be four, you know, companies that are going to control everything, and then you need to break them up. Is that kind of what you were talking about there with the dystopian feelings?
I think like we're talking about fear of being, you know, unsafe and, you know, destroyed morals, and tech will hurt our job and harm children and leads to a lot of ill. I think we had those fears throughout history with every new technology. And those technologies include, you know, the telegraph, and it was said those things about the Walkman. But, you know, the current techlash is much more serious than in past episodes. And one of the reasons I think we see those fear like bigger now is the tech companies' scale and bigness. Like you mentioned, we want to break them up. Because, you know, they all started as startups, and now they are the establishment involved in every aspect of our lives. And it's scary, right? And I think generally, if people feel the companies have got, you know, too big, too powerful, too rich, that in itself creates a backlash.
Absolutely. Now, reading your book, and, you know, I loved all your charts and everything, but it seemed to be that 2017 was quite a critical year in this whole process. And there's a lot of things that happened in 2017. Do you think that 2017 was significant in the, you know, the computer or IT world? And what kind of things happened in 2017?
Sure. So when I analyzed the coverage of 2017, the big stories, the major peaks of coverage in the company's timelines were negative. So various tech scandals. It was a turning point because, you know, in all the years beforehand, the major peaks of coverage in their timeline were positive. As I said, the product launch, the, you know, business reporting of their IPO or M&As and things like that. So that was a noticeable shift, which I saw in the data. And the major event like that caused this snowball thing to happen was actually at the end of 2016. So in November, Donald Trump became the president.
Yeah.
And the media blamed the tech platforms for widespread misinformation and disinformation. And when I asked the leading tech journalist what was like the story that formed the tech clash, they all answered in one way or another that it was the election of Donald Trump. And the way they phrased it, it was, okay, it wasn't the story that we wrote about the most, but it was the underlying thing for everything we said about the tech companies.
Yeah.
And then the new revelations regarding the Russian interference in the US election evolved, you know, into this bigger story during 2017. Micro-targeting advertising became this force of evil. We had the hearings in Congress at the end of 17. And on top of that, we had the what I call the accumulation of issues that like blow up during this year, because it wasn't just like the post-election reckoning with, you know, tech journalists and tech workers, but it was also many issues at once that like broke the camel's back. So we had various cases of extremist content and hate speech and like the fake news around the Las Vegas shooting, which was a shock to many. Major cyber attacks like WannaCry or data breaches like we had in Equifax.
Yeah.
It all like raised the alarm about data privacy and data protection, but we also had like allegations of anti-diversity, sexual harassment and discrimination culture. It was February 2017 that Susan Fowler published her revelations against Uber, and it was before the Me Too movement. And it already back then like, symbolized the toxicity, I think, in Silicon Valley. And I think all those time bombs started to detonate at once. So that was like the year of the shift.
That is true. And it's amazing how many things, like you said, and you mentioned quite a few more in the book, I think, all started to happen around that year, which is quite incredible. And then you mentioned in one of your previous answers about the fear that people have around big tech. And you said it's like a threat to values, to safety, to the interests of the community. Can you talk to us about, you know, how that came across in your book? How do people, what are people thinking about big tech as a threat?
Sure. Well, I'm a communication researcher, so I'm less into the, like, the public fears that you mentioned and more like the media depiction of those fears.
Yeah.
And, you know, you read the book, the media set the narrative. And the current framing is big tech is a threat. There used to be saviors, right?
Yeah.
And moved to threats. And I think it's understandable why journalists would want to focus on finding like the big tech misdeeds as they frequently happen. But more broadly, I think the stories that people remember and the most are the ones that truly change the world for the better are often the ones that like reveal wrongdoing and put a stop to it. And this is why I think we see more and more like those negative exposés and revelations and more journalists doing investigative reporting to have us all like safer from what seems to be an attack on our, you know, privacy and other issues. So that's one part of the fear game. The second thing I think additional player here is are the politicians. Because we're now witnessing even more political pushback around, you know, the core issues of the tech lash, such as, you know, content moderation, disinformation, data rights, antitrust and monopoly power. And those are all issues, you know, that we see in the US that are under investigation. And where when regulators are trying to have their impact here, the media covers it and makes the story, you know, even bigger. It gives like a justification to even focus in more on those issues.
And it's just amazing to me how, like Apple was, I'm just going to mention Apple. I shouldn't mention brands, but I'm going to mention Apple. It was always like the revered company. They could do nothing wrong. You know, the golden child, like amazing, amazing company. And then all of a sudden, like a year, maybe 18 months ago, there was all these little things creeping in. Maybe they're not so good. Maybe, you know, they're exploiting people. Maybe they're not dominating the market. Maybe they're doing this. And so you just see those little bit of like chinks in the Apple armor that, you know, they used to be, and you said in the beginning, they used to be the thing that people would tattoo on their arms and, you know, they would love Apple and put it on their laptops and always buy, you know, the MacBook and all that. And then suddenly they started to change. It's just interesting to see. And that's happening with a few of them as well, like Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, you know, the addiction for children, all those kind of things with the threats that are happening to them.
Yeah, I think I have an example in the book when I'm showing 2012. The major picks of coverage with Apple were its product launch of, you know, the new iPhone, iPad, iOS, and all the rest.
Yeah.
And they had already back then the Foxconn suicide. It was a huge scandal in my mind of all the suicides over there. But I needed to find it in the data, like in the graph, to mark, it was such a small peak of coverage. I mean, all the rest of their stories got so much more, like thousands more articles and posts from traditional media and tech blogs that what I thought was a big deal wasn't a big deal in their yearly timeline. Meaning, even though they had negative stories, it didn't stick. Like they had a few days of, you know, not a lot of coverage and the scandal is behind them. What I think is different now is if, you know, we'll find out about the suicide at Foxconn today, it will get much more media coverage and scrutiny.
Yeah, because they're not as protected as they once were, and people don't maybe idolize them as much as they used to. And
exactly.
Your book is called The Tech Lash and Tech Crisis Communication. I was very interested to read that section as well. And that's chapter 3. And I was drawn to the tech PR template for crisis. And you say it's being used repeatedly. Would you possibly, I know we're giving away secrets of your book, maybe, perhaps, but could you take us through an outline of what that PR template looks like? And maybe we can identify if we've seen it before.
Sure, gladly. I'm putting it out there for free. so yeah. When I analyzed the tech company's crisis responses, so I had different companies, a variety of negative stories, as we said, and yet, like, the PR responses were very much alike. Like, the companies rolled out the same playbook over and over again, like, copy-paste, copy-paste. And I just documented it. And then I grouped all the sentences into three main themes. The first narrative is what I called the victim-villain framing. So many responses praise the company's strict policies alongside, you know, we had good intentions and we had past good deeds. And here's the list of all the good things we've done successfully in the past. And then it was usually combined with scapegoating to shift the blame toward ours. So the basic accusation documented is of misuse, manipulation that have been done by bad actors. And the companies tend to do this strategy to claim, you know, they are victims of the crisis as well, like to emphasize their suffering since, yeah, we are good and, you know, an unfair victim of some malicious outside entity. So that's the first thing. The second thing is everybody remember the apology tours, right? So I call them pseudo-apologies. Many responses included different messages of we apologize, deeply regret, ask for forgiveness. But they actually were pseudo-apologies because they try at the same time, like the same statement, to minimize the severity of the offense or express sympathy without taking responsibility. And all the elements that I identified in number one, trying to shift the blame. So it's not true apology, right? It can't work.
Yeah, yeah.
Then there's the we need to do better statement.
Yeah.
We need to do better. I needed to call my book that name. My mistake. So it usually comes in this order. While we've made good, steady progress, made some strides, we have much more work to do. And we know we need to do better. I think almost every statement has this closure, right? And lastly, we have the corrective action messages. So many responses included immediate actions to fix the issues and further future improvements, like to prevent their reoccurrence. It's actually crisis communication 101. You have to have those, you know, corrective action messages. However, in the case of the companies, you know, their crises happen repeatedly. So preventing happened the reoccurrence. It's happening all again and again and again, right?
Yeah.
So they started adding, but our work will never be done. And this is not crisis communication 101, because when usually you've been advised to say, I'm going to fix it. This is how I'm going to fix it. And just leave me alone, right?
Yeah.
Let the new cycle move to the next thing, right? But saying our work will never be done is a very unique acknowledgement here in tech. You know, that some of the problems are too complicated to fix than to be solved. And it was very interesting to see this statement because it's like, I think, encapsulates big tech's never-ending challenge. Now, one way to look at the, you know, this PR template is to say, well, of course that this is their messaging. They're being asked to stop big, difficult societal problems. And that it's, you know, it's an impossible request. So they need to put up those messages.
Yeah.
But in reality, all of those tech left responses backlashed. The critics argued the tech companies need to stop, you know, taking the role of the victim, stop blaming others, don't ask for forgiveness, ask for permission. Or in other cases, it was, okay, your actions should follow your words. And even after the company specified their corrective actions, the critics claim the companies now ignored the system. Right? It's a different type of criticism because now, you have no incentive for dramatic changes like your business model. And in such case, like the media push for fundamental changes again and again, the PR playbook, you know, it won't help you.
Yeah. And this leads to chapter four of your fantastic book. And just to remind everyone that we're speaking to Dr. Nerit Weissblatt about her book called The Tech Lash and Tech Crisis Communication. And this leads to the chapter four, which is around the tech lash issues. And I suppose that, you know, you repeat your apology so many times that I guess people start to lose trust in you. And you've got a, you know, the trust is quite a you know, you highlight trust within your chapter there. Can you talk to us about a few areas and stats that you have in this section around trust? I found that very interesting.
Oh, thank you. Well, I think what the book shows is the accumulation of all those tech scandals generated a decline in trust, you know, specifically big tech. So I collected plenty of surveys about this issue, and I just chose a few examples for this section. And I think the main concerns are our personal information, misinformation and hate speech, polarization, and the company's monopoly power.
Yeah.
And when it comes to trust with our personal information, Facebook is getting the worst results by far, consistently. compared to, with the other tech companies. Another thing that came up is that, you know, I think specifically around social media, that this trust is remarkably bipartisan. I'm showing that, that there's an equal percentage of distrust among Republicans and Democrats, but for totally different reasons.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I think that overall, the interesting thing about trust, I think I wrote it in the book, is that it takes years to build, seconds to destroy, and forever to repair. And the companies have a long work ahead of them. Though, right. I also documented other results that I put in the book, results that can give them some hope. Because we are still having, a few results, right? that points to optimistic views, that the internet users see the platforms as more net positive to their world, to their lives, than net negative, like on balance, when you ask them that way, broader picture. So I think we have those surveys as well. Even a few weeks ago or months ago, it was at The Verge. They had the same results of huge optimism about the net positive of tech platforms to the world. It was surprising.
Yeah, and I think COVID has been obviously really, really good. They've benefited from COVID, all the big tech companies. And you can look at the graph of income and how they have just accelerated their income during COVID. But at the same time, I think you're right that I've been quite impressed with the way like Microsoft and Amazon have treated their employees and Salesforce, et cetera. So I think they've come across quite nice and sort of friendly, at least for their own employees, very considerate and understanding and those kind of things, which is the one of the positives maybe that you maybe spoke about there.
I think most people just use the products and don't think about all the harms because they're not like reading the tech news daily, hourly, like me, right? They just enjoy using it. So they don't have this critical thinking about those tools. I think most people.
Yeah. And so, Nerit, your last, I'm going to jump to the last part of your book, which is called The Post-Techlash Era. And if possible, and this is tricky, I'm going to ask you to put on your crystal, look into your crystal ball, and just maybe try and look into the future if you could. And what do you think is the future for big tech? Do you think they're going to continue to get bigger and dominate our lives more, grow in revenue? Every company is a tech company. Or do you think they are going to be broken up? Or are they going to even acquire each other? Are they going to go down from five big companies to two big companies at the end of the day? What do you think the future looks like?
Wow. Unfortunately, I don't have a crystal ball. but if I need to predict, then, big tech is only getting stronger. We see it. I think it won't be broken up anytime soon. But I think they will be more careful with some of the acquisitions due to there is a growing wave of antitrust scrutiny.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they would continue exploring new areas of expansion because it's their nature, growth at all costs.
Yeah, no, definitely. yeah, I think that's fine, Nerit. I can't predict the future either.
That's my best shot here.
can I talk to you about you for a moment? Maybe your plans for 21, and I see that you've got a blog, a website, viceblatt.blogspot.com. Can you talk to us a bit about your presence, on the internet, where people can find you, and what your plans are for the rest of the year?
Sure. So my plan now is promoting the book. I hope that it would reach, not only researchers and students, academic publisher, but also tech industry professionals, both, in tech journalism and tech PR. It's their story that I'm telling, so I hope they will find it useful. So that's like mission number one. Career-wise, I think I've proven to be agile. I pivoted from, tech public relations, consulting to companies, to tech journalism, covering innovation, to academic scholar, doing, comprehensive analysis of the tech field and the tech list. I think the best thing to do moving forward, which I didn't figure out yet, but I think it would be to utilize my tech expertise, which I've built for two decades, but I'm still young. I know I have a lot of experience and knowledge to bring to the table. I'm not sure yet where that table would be, but I'm open for, to my next adventure.
And are you quite active on Twitter?
No, actually, I just rejoined Twitter after a long, long break. My new account there is Dr. Techlash. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'm like publishing my thoughts on the tech news of the day, but actually seeing my writing is, as you said, in my tech blog, Nirit Weisblatt, and I have my posts over there. It's more long form, and you can also find me, of course, on LinkedIn and Facebook under Nirit Weisblatt PhD, and of course there's the techlashbook.com website about the book with more information.
Nirit, thank you so much for joining me. I really, really appreciate it, taking your time, looking me up. And I thoroughly enjoyed your book. I encourage everyone to read it. It gives you a really full, rounded view of the situation where we're in today. So I really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. That was a pleasure. Thank you.
And so just to remind, we've been speaking to Dr. Nirit Weisblatt, and her book is The Techlash and the Tech Crisis Communication. And you can read it for the PR templates, amongst other things. And all the information, there's lots and lots and lots of information. So I hope you, the listener, found this as interesting and useful as I did. If you'd like to contact me, then please do. My email is lance@ideastorm.co.za. And so if you like Nirit and you've written a book, then please contact me. And I would more than happy to reach out to you, to engage with you. I'm always keen to learn what you've learned. I don't learn things. I'm not a researcher myself, and so I have to learn from people like you. Or you can go to my website as well, so businessbookshelfpodcast.com, and have a look there. So thank you again, Nirit. Enjoy the rest of your day and week and year, and we'll get through this COVID. And I look forward to seeing the great adventure that awaits for you coming forward.